You're listening to a Stranger podcast, www.thestranger.com.
Thank you for downloading yet another Dear Science podcast. I am Jonathan Golub, the senior science stringer at The Stranger, and with me this week is Jen Graves, visual art editor, and she has a podcast of her own, Invisible, which you should check out. Jen, what describe Invisible for us here?
Invisible is a weekly conversation with people in art, and you can get it on www.thestranger.com. This week it's with Brad Biancardi, Seattle painter.
Excellent.
And I'm eating a bagel that you made for me.
Yes, science can bake bagels. It's quite the many talent here. So Jen is here to talk, because I saw at her recommendation a movie a couple weekends ago called My Kid Could Paint That, which has at its core the question whether or not modern art paintings painted by a four-year-old were fraudulent or not. Were they really painted by the four-year-old or were they not? And so maybe, Jen, you could, stand as the art expert, we're going to have you maybe describe it for us.
Well, so this girl was, she was 4 years old then, she's seven now, and her name is Marla Olmsted. She made some paintings at home. Her father was an amateur painter. And he gave her canvases and paints and, you know, not the usual kid stuff, paper, but he actually gave her canvas. And she made some paintings and just kind of on a whim, they hung them up at a friend's coffee shop. People started asking to buy them. So before long, Marla has herself an art dealer. And what happens is that the documentarian gets involved at the point where Marla begins to become famous and thinks he's just making a documentary about a famous four-year-old possible prodigy of abstract painting. At which point, things really take a turn when 60 Minutes does a documentary and Barlev, the documentarian, thinks he's just going to be capturing on film the family's kind of response to a happy celebratory piece about their kid, when it actually turns out to be an expose. They've, you know, this show, the TV show, has planted hidden cameras in the basement where Marla paints and seen her father giving her this sort of direction and telling her what to do and use red and do this. And, you know, this is just an outcry. So the rest of the film is really devoted to kind of the obsessive attempt to get Marla to paint a painting from start to finish on camera, and she won't do it. So it's kind of what you're left with after that, and there are some amazing characters in this. My favorite one is the dealer.
This is modern art painting, and the guy is a photorealistic painter, and so he feels
rejected by modern by art, by the art world, right? Which, I mean, the abstract expressionists, you know, Pollock and these painters that have now become famous, but also kind of the butt of jokes about My Kid Could Do That. Those paintings were made as kind of a result of the interaction between the artist and the canvas. And there was the sense that those paintings were special because they recorded a really charged event that happened. Right?
Mm-hmm.
While the painting was being made. So there's this kind of outpouring of the artist onto the canvas. The question, of course, becomes, well, what can a four-year-old pour out onto a canvas?
I see.
And the dealer, as soon as 60 Minutes starts questioning her, the dealer's, well, I never really liked modern art. I was actually just doing this to critique modern art, which is total crap. And he just abandons her. He says, nope, it's crap. Modern art is all crap. And then by the end of the movie, he's selling her paintings again. And he's like forcing people to buy her paintings. And forcing them to buy the ones he wants them to buy.
The one that was actually filmed on camera and supposedly the proof that you could...
Well, the parents filmed it.
The parents filmed this one. So... Dear listener, you're listening to a science podcast. You're probably a little bit confused now. Why are we talking about modern art? And the key thing is, when I was sitting in this film about a completely divergent field from where I am, where I'm working, I was sort of struck by all of the parallels, right? You know, what got these paintings so famous initially was that it was so unexpected. A four-year-old could produce modern impressionist paintings that are so similar, you know, at least on a level with what you would see from an adult, and this sort of that it was like the punchline except real, And that's why I got all the attention. And I think the most clever character to my mind in the whole film was the newspaper columnist, again, not to toot our own horns.
She was interesting.
She was very interesting, and she made a very salient point that going through the sort of media cycle, and these, and when you're taking a specialized field and throwing it into mass media, mm-hmm. you have to have first, like, oh wow, something really unexpected happened, and then if you want to keep selling the story, something has to change. And most often, it starts to be criticism. You start grinding it up, and so, so in that sense, you saw what happened with this family, whether it was fraudulent or not, mm-hmm. how they were first pumped and then they were shredded, mm-hmm. and this happens a lot. A lot in science. And so you can, you mean, you can see it. I mean, you know, going, rolling back, you know, like, there a couple weeks ago, there was this thing, you know, worms, nematodes, which don't even have male and female. They have male and hermaphrodite, you know, male and female together, right? So, and they found a gene that, you know, a series of neurons that you, if you tweaked them or got rid of them, they, you could change sexual behavior. You could make a male act like a hermaphrodite, make a hermaphrodite act like a male. And suddenly now, and then, and so that's a very tight focus story. Like, C. elegans, the animal they did this test on, it's actually a worm, and it's so simple that you can actually count and name every single cell in it. So, like, so it wasn't like, oh, it was the class of neurons, or like, it was that neuron number, you know, XX, you know, 322, and we killed it. And then, you know, now it's gay, right? And it's, but you're talking about a very, very simple model system. It wasn't really the point. And then it gets grabbed up in the mass media as, you know, now scientists have figured out how to control, you know, the gay gene or the gay switch. And then it becomes, oh my God, they're gonna, we're gonna try to get rid of gay kids. And, and it's the same sort of, and it's the same sort of news cycle. You see this, and so, and
well, what, can I add something?
Yeah, yeah.
Because this really funny. You should bring that up. When I was viewing the movie, I wanted to look at the news that had been put out there, and so I looked at the New York Times, which was the first place the story hit nationally.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually did a story. They did the first story. Marla is a 4-year-old kid. She's making these paintings. People are buying them for thousands of dollars. Marla sold $300,000 worth of paintings.
Holy cow!
Yeah. And she's still making paintings.
Listeners, science is never that lucrative.
Neither is art. Unless you apparently get this dealer involved.
Yeah, exactly.
Who hates your art anyway. But basically, you know, there was this amazing follow-up story where the New York Times did this thing, and it was a piece, it was sort of questioning it, but it was actually also sort of a piece about how to tell whether your 4-year-old is an abstract painting or not. And they did, I think they actually did the experiment, the Times subsidized experiment, where they brought all these kids in to these workshops and then had a specialist talking about, like, well, this one I see does this and this, and this one.
Because this is
like
where
a test field.
Yeah, and this rolled back to me because, you know, the crux of the 60-minute expose piece on Marla was a child prodigy expert. I don't even know what degree one gets for this, but regardless. And she's like, well, this is pure speculation. But, and it's always the but, and this is when you know you're doomed, right? When the first half of the sentence is, well, this is pure speculation, but I don't see any reason to believe that she's a prodigy, and everyone sort of drops the, you know, the first half, the dependent clause, and then you get the sort of the big punch in the gut, and sometimes it's well deserved, you know, honestly, and you know, I feel badly. You should go see the movie for sure, and make your own judgment. I one of the damning moments in the film was they show Marla's paintings that were painted with her on camera, whether the 60 Minutes crew or her parents, next to her other paintings, the mm-hmm. paintings where it wasn't documented. And even with my untrained eye, you could see a qualitative difference between the paintings that they had documented proof that Marla had done from start to finish and the paintings mm-hmm. that were not. And so this gets interesting because, you know, in my field, the field I work in, so, you know, despite my sort of getting many questions on climate change and what you should be eating or not be eating, I'm actually an embryonic stem cell biologist. I work in heart disease. And this is a field where there's been a couple really big cases of fraud and some really sort of exciting data that's just now tipping through the news cycle. And so the two big things that had come up, one was this idea that you could get new heart cells from bone marrow. You could, you know, you can grab cells that are only, there's a story in stem cell biology. Stem cells are cells that don't do anything. They can become cells. So like if you skin your knee, you get new skin from somewhere, and that somewhere is little skin stem cells that live at the bottom of all your hair follicles. And so, but the idea is like skin stem cells can only make skin. That makes sense. If you skin your knee, you don't want like brain to be pouring out of your kneecap. You want skin or hair oil or something that makes sense to be in skin. happen. And so that was the idea for decades and decades and decades. Stem cells are limited in what they can become. And so that's why if you have a heart attack, no stem cells really in the heart, or if there are, they're really lazy. You never replace that lost heart, unlike, you know, say if you skin your knee. And so the big story that came out in the late 90s was you could take, you know, these adult stem cells from bone, from liver, from skin, and you could, or fat, you know, fat was super popular. You could take fat stem cells and you could somehow get them to become heart cells. You squirt them in a heart, they make new heart, and then you cure heart disease. And this is going to be wonderful and fantastic, and the world's going to be a beautiful place, and everything's going to be solved. And it got picked up by the mass media because it was so unexpected. You know, wow, all you need to do is liposuct our way to health, you know, and it'll be a glorious new world. And then other labs started to try to do it and started to try to pick at it. And it was actually the lab I work in, full disclosure, and a couple other labs, a lab in Indiana, and a couple other labs that tried to reproduce it, couldn't do it, and actually demonstrated that it was artifacts. It was sort of things that weren't, it was just a little bit of maybe ways you can imagine the first experimenters got a little bit duped or just maybe didn't do all the controls they needed to do. And so it ended up not being true. And it hasn't quite gone through the news cycle because the politics have sort of wrapped into this. This is where I think where maybe science gets a little different from the art world. But they both end up bumping into politics and all this. But you could see the news cycle going through. I think it has a very negative distorting effect on science, and I was getting into the sense it has a negative distorting effect on the art world as well. This sort of mass media news cycle where you gobble up the unexpected, and a lot of things in science, when you have something unexpected, it happens on occasion, but more often it's a little artifact or something that just wasn't quite as carefully done. So you have, you know, another example in my field is like the amniotic fluid stem cells, which I wrote in the column about quite a while ago, which you can check out. But I don't think the researchers were fraudulent in the sense that they were intentionally trying to deceive, but a little bit careless, kind of stretching a little bit beyond it, and it gets picked up. And again, you get that, well, this is just pure speculation, but then it gets picked up in the media. But these can replace embryonic stem cells, you know. And then you have the authors, the scientists of this paper being like, no, there's no way. These cannot actually replace embryonic stem cells, but it's kind of almost too late then, right? And I don't even know. And this is kind of where maybe a good discussion, you know, I don't know how you fix this, because I view this as a problem.
I think the mass media is, it's intended to reflect our fantasies and anxieties. And that's something that we forget when we're looking at something, especially we forget the metabolism of the media. A story that hits one day, it's completely bowled over the next day. I mean, mm-hmm. completely rolled over the next day. And it's that like continuous attention to the cycle that, you know, that doesn't necessarily seem to happen. And I think, you know, people see what they want to see. I mean, that's sort of what you see about this great clash of stuff in this movie where, you know, this is a filmmaker who's trying not to see what he wants to see. He really wants her to be the painter, mm-hmm. you know, the quote unquote real painter, you know, mm-hmm. and everybody wants her to be the real painter, except for the people who really don't want her to be the real painter, you know, really want to prove it that it's not true. And there's this kind of continuous, like, attempt to see something that exists outside of just what you want to see or what you don't.
Yeah,
see.
So, but, I mean, that's one of the things I was thinking about in the movie is if they had said it's like a father-daughter painting team,
right.
and that was the original
right.
story,
right.
it would have, you know, they probably would have been home free, it would have been no questioning
right.
at all,
right.
and it probably would have had that, just enough of that ring of adorableness to actually,
right.
you know, to actually
right.
zip through, you know, like, and that was, this is the other thought
but
that kind of came through.
But it wouldn't have hit the New York Times.
I don't know. I can't judge it, but it's one of those things where I like to think, you know, like there's like the stretch and then there's like sort of like the fiasco stretch.
Right.
And this is sort of like the fiasco stretch. Oh no, 4-year-old paints from start to finish, you know, and all I do is set up the paint for her and clean up her hands afterwards,
right.
which is sort of like the calamitous stretch. And then there's like, well, she does it, but we kind of work together on it. It may have not hit the New York Times, but I have a feeling it has just enough of that ring of kind of adorableness
yeah.
that I think would be a big thing. And I think a lot of these sort of incremental science papers, like there's a growing kind of bouncing back to my field, there's a little bit of story that maybe there are stem cells in the heart that could maybe we could somehow massage and get them working a little bit better. I personally think the data is not completely certain yet. Mm. But when you get a paper or a claim that, oh, suddenly now we can just cure heart disease by squirting in a couple drugs, that's sort of, again, like the fiasco stretch. And just a little bit of search, like, hey, actually, maybe there are some cell in the heart that can fix things up a little bit. Kind of isn't ready a little segue. So I've been getting a lot of fraud questions from my column. They're sort of like the teenage boy questions, one of which was, how can you scientifically tell the difference between fake breasts and real breasts? And I'm gonna save that one. I think I'm not going to research that quite yet. But another one I got is, how can you tell if a girl is faking an orgasm? And I haven't quite written, it's not quite out yet, and you'll have to look for it in a future column, but I don't know. You think this is a legitimate scientific question, a legitimate scientific inquiry to get into?
Sure.
So I'm here to tell you that by far the best way scientifically to determine if a girl has had an orgasm remains the simplest and easiest way, which is to ask. Right? That is how most female sexuality studies do it, is by questionnaire. And I can understand that bubble forms might take the mood out a little bit out of the situation, but it remains the most reliable way, the way that most tightly matches with this, what is kind of nicely referred to in the literature as the subjective experience of an orgasm, is the asking after the fact, did you have an orgasm? Can you orgasm? Allows you to have an orgasm? And so surveys. And asking seems to me the best way of, if there is a problem, of solving it. You know, like going to a doctor, there are some things like testosterone level and blah, blah, blah. There's some organic cause. This is another thing that's sort of about the 70s, they discovered that women also had sexuality in science. And so the literature is sort of catching up with male sexuality. Definitely there are organic causes and everything else.
Is there anything you can actually do in your bed without being tied to a, you know, can a woman be caught?
There's a couple tricks, right? So, like, both men and women have sexuality controlled by the autonomic nervous system, which is sort of like the automatic parts of your body, and so you have two big stretches of it, right? You got the feed and breed half of it, which is parasympathetic, and this is sort of like the laying on the couch mode of your body, right? You're kind of sitting, you're digesting, you're just relaxing. And there are a couple little signs for it. You have really, your pupils are a little bit smaller. There are a couple little things with that. And then you have the sympathetic nervous system, which is called the fight and flight one. So you get muscle, blood rushing to your muscles, heart racing. It's sort of the adrenaline rush. One of the things that also comes with is big blown pupils, so you can see whatever tiger is coming to eat you or whatever in the dark. So in sex, the mnemonic used by medical students everywhere is point and shoot. So arousal is the parasympathetic nervous system. So you get these sort of relaxed, kind of calm sort of things that sort of build up and build up and build up. And then shoot is the sympathetic nervous system. And that is orgasm and men ejaculation. And so
This is science's mnemonic.
This is how science passed his med school classes, right? We won't even go into how I remember the bones of the wrist, right? life really has taken many interesting turns here. So you look at shoot, right? Sympathetic, you know, adrenaline rush. So think about the kind of things that happen when you have an adrenaline rush. Your pupils get big, you get a cold sweat, your heart starts to beat a little bit faster, So if you're in the bed and you're looking around, you may have to have lights on, which is something else to consider.
Pry open the eyes. Put
your hand on the heart. Feel for a cold sweat on the bottom of the feet.
And really? That's the place?
I don't know.
You might need several people.
I mean, again, you know.
to take this test.
Yeah, exactly. It's a nice reductionist way of sort of getting at the problem, I think, here. I still think.
Why ask when you can do that?
Yeah, exactly. Get some objective data on the fact. It was sort of fun to research. Yes.
There's also a really quick way to tell whether a person is an artist. It involves basically the same. You just need to put your hands on certain parts of the body, and then you can tell.
Well, what parts?
They vibrate and glow.
Mm-hmm. Can you quantify glow? We could probably sell it to a merch.
Well, it depends on the color. The type of artist depends on the color.
I'm sure there's a market for a pill that makes you an artist. Mm-hmm. I can feel it coming. Yeah, well, we can work on that together.
We give it to Marla.
Yeah, give it to Marla, exactly. We'll sequence her genes. It'll be perfectly ready for it.
She'll be gay and an artist.
Yes, well.
And she might maybe eventually have an orgasm. We'll test that,
and we'll be able to objectively prove. And not just be really on these unreliable talkings with your sex partner. Really, point and shoot. The key to Cappy lifestyle here. So this is yet another Dear Science podcast. You can read my column and download the podcast every week at www.thestranger.com. I am Jonathan Golub, and thank you, Jen Graves.
Thank you.